south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. Everyone likes to talk about doing business in Latin America because I'd say at least half the people coming down, that is, gringos and expats, want to start a business or end up doing so. And you know, it's been a couple of years since I've talked about one of the most popular means of doing business here for gringos and expats, that is buying into a franchise. And you know, there's two kind of franchises, international first world franchises like McDonald's and Starbucks, and local Latin American franchises. In fact, when you get boots on the ground here south of the border, you'll be surprised at just how many franchises you see. They're everywhere. Most of the names you'll never recognize because they are Latin franchises that don't exist up in the States. Though some of them are spectacularly famous down here, you've never seen any of them. Though, like transplanted first world franchises, they easily roll off the tongues of Latins like McDonald's, Kentucky Fried, and Pizza Hut. By the way, the latest first world franchise arrival down here is Carl's Jr. 2 years ago, they didn't exist, and now they're sprouting up everywhere. Now, of course, it doesn't take much of an eye to notice there's a big difference between first-world franchises like Carl's Jr. and their Latin franchise counterparts. Sure, there are hundreds of Latin American franchises, but the fact is 99.9% of them would never survive a week up in the first world. Again, it's all about the maintenance, the standards, the culture, not to mention the normally disgusting state of the restrooms. And it's not a stretch to say that the vast majority of successful Latin franchises got there by sheer luck, mostly because they were the first one in with a certain product. Which is why, when first world franchises land, they almost always succeed beyond their wildest dreams. Just look at Walmart. It's the biggest employer in all of Latin America. How'd that happen? And 20 years ago, not a single Walmart down here. Then you have McDonald's, the biggest fast food employer. Second biggest, Subway. Burger King and Domino's Pizza, third and fourth largest fast food employers. Get the picture? That's one of the beauties of coming here to Latin America and opening up a business. Franchise or not, Latins love everything first world and gringo. On top of that, most of these places pay minimum wage, which in Latin America ranges from $250 to $400 a month. About five times the minimum wage up in the States, not to mention up where you live. The employer has to kick in an additional 7.5% for FICA, workman's comp, and other benefits. All of that almost non-existent down here. Which is why down here you can employ five workers for the cost of one worker in the very same business up in the first world. I know, it doesn't seem fair, but it is a huge advantage for the business owner. What are you going to do? That said, if you check on the internet, you'll find you can download reports and books that show all of the different franchises that are for sale all over the world. You'll find out there are more than 4,000 that are available. As mentioned before, when you're down here in Latin America with boots on the ground, you'll see a lot of franchises that are local Latin franchises. So, for example, in a country like, let's say, El Salvador, you'll find maybe 20 or 30 hardware stores with the exact same name. It's a franchise. However, these are local franchises that never broke out beyond their own country's borders, and only about 10% of successful local franchises ever do. By the way, not 1 in 100 ever make it to the first world. That being the case, turns out as of the 1st of January 2017, there are about 400 different franchises located throughout Latin America. So, since there are over 4,000 franchises available internationally now, and only 400 exist in Latin America. That means only 10% of the available franchises have made it down, meaning the franchise business down here in Latin America is new and booming, with plenty of lag time built in, which makes us gringos look like we're clairvoyants when we bring them down and they kick ass. There's even a new Latin American franchise organization. It's called Federación de la Iberoamericana Franquicias, FIAF. By the way, franchises are called franquicias in Spanish. Franquicias. So this group, kind of like a Rotary Club for franchises in Latin countries, includes Mexico, Guatemala, Costa Rica, Colombia, Venezuela, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, Peru, Brazil, Portugal, and, wouldn't you know it, Spain itself, the mother country. Because, you see, after those famous, or you could say infamous, well-known first-world junk and fast food franchises like McDonald's Kentucky Fried and Domino's Pizza first hit Latin America, the next big wave of franchises came in directly from Spain. Those Spain franchises were lucky. It was a perfectly easy and natural transition for them. They already had their marketing, documents, employee handbooks, signs, etc. in Spanish. So all they had to do was clone that stuff directly and send it over. Whereas, for example, a first world franchise company like Sizzler or Carl's Jr. had to jump over that language and cultural barrier with every aspect of their business. So again, bottom line, there are 1/10 as many franchises here in Latin America as there are up where you live in Cucamonga or Cleveland. So do keep that in mind if your plan B involves starting a business. However, you also have to keep in mind that buying into a first world franchise and bringing it down to Latin America is not going to be cheap. However, once you get it off the ground south of the border, you'll find your profit margins are double, even triple, compared to the same franchise numbers up in the States. Because, you see, the price of a Whopper or a Little Caesar's Pizza Pizza is the same down here as it is in Atlanta, with rent, labor, and other overhead costs at 1960s and 70s levels down here. All right, now for another personal opinion. I've seen many, many gringos start businesses. I've seen them bring first world franchises down too. Like, believe it or not, Dunkin' Donuts and Dairy Queen. Yep, they're down here too. And guess what? Even though their businesses are doing fine, more than fine, none of them seem very happy. As one of them told me, it's a regular grind and you have to be there all the time, or the standards just start slipping. However, I've also seen a lot of very happy gringo businessmen and women who just love going to work because they've got their own little niche business, something they started and got off the ground all by themselves that has nothing to do with the franchise and just might not be connected to anything first world at all. So yes, you bring a franchise down, you're bound to make some money, but it's a grind, and most gringos who end up in that business down here, or even up in the States, say it's just another kind of treadmill. Which brings us to this short email I thought you might be interested in. This comes from a very young guy who came down to my last Expat Insider seminar. That was in the first week of January, about exactly 2 months ago. This young guy stayed on after the seminar, and he's still down here. He wants more boots on the ground and to check out business opportunities. He's a guy who's never been out of the U.S. before. I could be wrong, but this might have been his first plane flight, too. In fact, I recall at the seminar, he was on the phone quite a bit, talking to his family members back in the States. They were checking on him daily to make sure he wasn't kidnapped or shot, sold into the white slave trade, or had his organs harvested, whatever. Anyway, let me read this little email he just sent me. He said, "Hi, Johnny. I'm in Panajachel right now." By the way, if you're driving to the most beautiful lake in the world, Lake Atitlan, that's the first city you land in. Panajachel. Anyway, he says, "I'm in Panajachel at Lake Atitlan, and I'm trying to start three businesses simultaneously. I'm starting a restaurant, making soap, and trying to export custom-made hand-sewn items. So I've been pretty busy getting these things off the ground, and it's working out pretty good. Hope things are going good for you, too. By the way, Johnny, I'm coming to Guatemala City in a couple days, and I plan on going to PriceMart, the Latin version of Costco, to buy all the stuff I need for my new restaurant. And while there, I want to get a dental checkup. And I need a favor, Johnny. Can you give me the name and number of your favorite dentist there? Thanks a bunch, Johnny. Mr. M, a recent seminar guy." All right, it's me, Johnny, again. Doesn't that little email speak volumes? By the way, speaking of happiness, a steadily eroding commodity up where you live, the other day I went with a rather fresh expat gringo to a doctor's office, an ophthalmologist, a specialist. He's a guy who's probably a 1 on the 10 scale for Spanish and didn't want to go to the doctor alone, even though I explained to him almost all medical doctors and professionals under 50 speak passable English. These days, they have to pass that international English test called TOEFL, T-O-F-E-L, to get out of medical school. And it seems I just wasn't able to convince my new gringo friend of that until he actually got in the office and saw it for himself. Now, the fact is, when you're off the gringo tourist trail, well off it like I am, Even in big Latin cities, you could walk into the doctor's office and he or she might be the only one that speaks English in the place. So as you walk up to the receptionist, you just might have one big communication breakdown. But not to worry, as soon as you see the doctor, he'll speak some English and he'll help you fill out the forms. Anyway, I found myself sitting in the waiting room next to an older Latin guy with a patch over his eye. And I made the mistake of asking him what had happened to his eye. And he was very frank with me. He said, "I have cancer." And I was thinking, oh, shit. Talking about a gringo sticking his foot in his mouth, huh? Well, how was I to know? So what do you say after that? Well, you try to lighten up the conversation, right? And I said, "Well, how's it going? You look good." He said, "Well, I'm gonna die." Well, I was digging myself into an even deeper hole there. How do you follow that one up? So to fill that big pregnant pause that came next, I said, "We're all gonna die, but hopefully not for a long time yet." Then he shook his head and said, "Doctor says I won't last the year out. Hope I make it to Easter." So now, suddenly, I'm in one of the most depressing conversations I've been in a long, long time. So what could I say but, "Man, sorry about that." Then he cracked a genuine smile and said, "Don't be sorry. I'm not. I really had a nice, long, happy life." And at that moment, I was guessing he was maybe 55. That's not long. Then he said, "You know what, Hovind?" Hovind means young fella. By the way, you'll hear that a lot if you're a gringo male. Hovind. Now, believe it or not, many, many Latin males and females over 50 will refer to us gringo males as Hovind. Latins who say that to us are not trying to butter us up. They really mean it. Hovind. They always think we're much younger than we really are. Another gringo advantage, I guess. Which always makes me laugh because many times the person that's saying it will be older than you are. But don't correct him. Why ruin the fantasy, huh? So anyway, this poor guy with the eye patch said to me, "Listen, young man, Hovind, when you find out you're going to die, strange things go through your head. You mourn for your friends before you ever get the chance to mourn for yourself." He said, "You find yourself relieved that you won't have to be there for their funerals." And you know, to me, that says quite a lot about the happiness situation in Latin America and why you'll never hear that kind of optimism come out of the mouth of a first world person. Imagine being relieved that you won't have to suffer through your own friends' funerals. Yeah, you know, different cultures and all that, but remember, this guy was probably only in his mid-50s. All right, on a lighter note, or maybe it isn't. I've gotten a few emails lately from people asking me about environmental impact studies in Latin America. Well, it's like this. All Latin countries have what they call Departamentos de Ambiente or Departamentos de Recursos Naturales. Loosely translated, Environmental Protection and Natural Resource Departments. Yep, they've got big first world sounding names in big, expensive government buildings with huge staffs. Of course, 10 or 15 years ago, these things didn't even exist here in Latin America. But of course, they copy everything first world, so that continues the trend. Anyway, if you're going to take out any kind of building permit and you're next to a protected wildlife area or park, or you're next to a body of water, river, or navigable stream, chances are, if you're building a commercial property, you will have to do an environmental impact study. All right, you might be thinking, good idea, right? Save nature, air, water, wildlife, and all that. Good idea. Except, you know, this is Latin America. And even though an environmental study like that will cost about 10% of what it would up in the States, the money still ends up getting wasted or in the hands of government pus bags or worse. In fact, I just spoke to a Belgian guy and a guy from Spain. They're presenting a hotel project right now that'll be built in Honduras on the Caribbean coast. And they told me that they had to pay around $10,000 to do an environmental impact study, which will end up being a 60-room hotel. Now, the Spanish guy mentioned that that same environmental impact study, if it had been in Spain, would cost him around $100,000. And he said along the way, they'd stack on so many regulations and changes, you'd spend another $100,000 on top of that. That, he said, was why they were building it in Honduras. And the bad news? Well, he said, the problem is with the other properties nearby where we're going to build the hotel. There's a little town about a kilometer away right on the ocean. They've got little businesses, mom and pop restaurants, grocery stores, and little, mostly run-down hotels on or near the beach that never, ever had to do an environmental impact study. Because he said, for one thing, the bureaucracy didn't exist years ago when they first set up shop. But he said, that's not what really bothers him. This is what really pisses him off. 75% of the little towns up and down the beach, for as far as the eye can see, have no sewage treatment whatsoever. That means all gray and wastewater end up in the ocean. Meanwhile, only a half a kilometer away or less will be his very first world project, where he's done a $10,000 environmental impact study. He'll install a $30,000 holding tank and treatment plant for his gray and wastewater, while most all of his neighbors are dumping theirs right into the ocean. But that's not all, he said. In our case, he says, 10 grand for the study and 30 grand for the treatment plant. That's nothing. It's the government delays in processing that paperwork that screws us all up. So, he says, they get their 10 grand up front, and we gotta wait 6 months before we get the authorization to stick one shovel in the ground. However, he did say, unlike in Spain, once you get that permit and build a project, the government lardasses will never come around again. They won't do periodic inspections, they don't have the crew, nor the persistence or the mandate to do any kind of follow-up or harassment. Though he said you can count on a few government types showing up at the restaurants with their wives or mistresses. They'll hang around the beach in the pool and expect a few free drinks to be forthcoming. All right, as far as actually building a brick and mortar something or other down here, if it's a big commercial or tourism project, you better believe there's going to be a lot of permits, a ton of paperwork. Your lawyer will have to visit a lot of useless government departments, get signatures and stamps and such. The government delays will take months. However, if it's a small brick and mortar project, a private house, a mom and pop little business, if you go through the usual channels, have an architect draw up your plans and stuff, go down to a municipality, hand it in, get it approved. If you don't need an environmental impact study, it could take just a month and then you can get started. Remember, an environmental impact study only has to be done if it's a big commercial project or it's on a river or a lake or next to a national park or wildlife refuge. On the other hand, if there's already a building or house on the premises and you're remodeling or adding a garage or a breezeway or a pool, you almost never have to pull a permit. Of course, up in the first world, it's a big no-no and a big fine if you get caught after you've done a project and didn't pull a permit. In fact, they'll make you tear it out, even if you're just going to remodel your basement or a bathroom. Sure, you can often get away with it if it's inside of your house, but don't ever try that outside. Not if you're living up in the States, anyway. The people down at your local assessor's office are going to pick it up on Google Earth, Google Maps, or even with their own drones. Luckily, none of that's happening down here in Latin America. Oh, that's not to say Latin governments aren't checking out Google Maps and Google Earth to look at people's properties. Well, they're doing that in some of the big Latin cities now, only to try to get somewhat accurate property assessments for tax purposes. That's because, like I mentioned in a previous show, most properties in Latin America are assessed at ridiculously low values. Turns out with most houses and buildings, except with brand new properties, who happen to list their real selling prices in real estate magazines and such, so they have to be registered on the government property tax rolls that way. That said, brand new properties do pay much higher property taxes. But as far as older real estate properties are concerned, some are registered on the books for as little as 10% of their real market value, which is why property taxes are so ridiculously low here in Latin America compared to what you pay. So let me repeat. Many people I know have $300,000 to $400,000 houses and they're only paying something like $200 to $500 a year in property taxes. Of course, even then it's a ripoff because they don't get anything for their money, but do you? So anyway, if you hire a contractor to build your garage, you got to remember a couple of things. No one down here is bonded. They don't even know what that is. So if you ask them if they're bonded, they're going to give you a kind of a Stevie Wonder look. Not to mention there's no such thing as workers' comp. So if someone gets injured on your job, they just go off to the hospital and the next day the contractor brings in another worker. And maybe some days later, the injured guy will show up too. Another thing to remember is if you're doing a small project, remodeling, building a garage, whatever, there most likely won't be any kind of paperwork or contract for you and the contractor to sign at all. Most small projects like that go down with simply a handshake deal. That's not to say you couldn't have a contract. Sure, you can draw one up, get your lawyer to do it, go that route. But if somehow you get scammed along the way, you almost never have a way to get any recourse. Sure, you can sue the guy, bring him to court, but Most of your small-time Latin contractors don't have a pot to pee in either. Maybe a beat-up pickup truck and some power tools, but that's about it. So how do you find a decent contractor you can trust? Well, it's almost always word of mouth, and it's buyer beware, which is a good thing. Now, I've seen a lot of Latin contractors, good, bad, ugly, and sloppy. And it's easy to say, well, just check out a contractor by word of mouth. But how do you do that? Well, for example, if you're living in a guarded, gated community, there's always some kind of construction activity going on somewhere in that subdivision. A new house, a garage, a room addition, whatever. And let's say you want a swimming pool dug or an addition to your house. Well, you just go over and ask the owner who's hired those contractors for his project and ask him if he'd recommend that same crew again for another project. Ask them if they're doing good work and if they're on time and on budget. By the way, if you're doing a small project like a garage, usually what you'll do is give the guy 50% down when he starts the job and 50% on completion. But make sure they completely clean up the site and leave no loose ends when you give them that final amount, because most likely if you have any kind of complaint after the fact, they're probably not coming back unless you show them some more money. And pay special attention to the ripio, that's ripio, the garbage or refuse that accumulates around the site. Let's say, for example, part of the job entails breaking up an old cement slab and pouring a new one. Well, what are they going to do with the old stuff, the broken up pieces? Generally, they'll just leave it in a pile outside the house or in the field next door or across the street. Well, you can't have that. But if you paid them up in full, they'll never come back and take it away. So you wait till that's off the site before you pay them their final amount. Oh, and one more thing. I mentioned this in a show a long time ago. There are really no guarantees when it comes to contractors down here. Oh, sure, they'll all say they guarantee their work for 1, 2, even 5 years. You can even write that up in a contract if you want. But like I've said a dozen times before, once they've walked away and they've been paid, you're not going to get them back on the job unless you pay them something again. And here's a good example of what I'm talking about. Isn't it true everyone loves a sunken living room? Kind of elegant in a way. Standard old tract homes don't have them. Takes a little bit extra dough and a little bit extra planning to make a nice sunken living room with a fireplace and all that, right? By the way, almost all middle, upper middle, and high class Latin homes have fireplaces. Now, that doesn't mean they're ever used at all. I mean, Latin America's hot, right? Even in the Altiplano, where it's constant spring-like weather, I know many, many people who have fireplaces and have never fired them up once. But they look nice, right? Kind of like jacuzzis. Even saunas. If you have any of those things in your home, you'll find out you almost never use them. But they do add a little upscale elegance to your house and serve to impress visitors and company, right? Which may be their real purpose after all. Anyway, I know of a few upscale Latins who built houses with sunken living rooms, and man, those rooms looked nice and elegant for the first couple of years. And now, suddenly, the parts of the wall that are below grade are showing signs of mold, humidity, and paint peeling. In other words, they've got more than the beginning of a nice moisture problem that's never going to go away unless someone comes with a backhoe or something and digs out the foundation on the outside of the building and lays down some real nice first-world-style waterproofing along those walls and backfill it with the right material and in the proper way. Which, of course, should have been done when those houses were built, but the average Latin knows absolutely nothing about construction and just hires a firm to come in and build them a house. I guess that's exactly what people do up in the States, too, right? However, up in the States, contractors are bonded and have to give a sort of a guarantee and are held to it because you can get sued and go to court and pay damages up there. But down here, like I said, forget about it. In fact, even if it's a big commercial project you're building, the court systems down here are so slow and lax. If you do take someone to court, it could take years and years, which is one reason why so few people are sued down here, which is a good thing, right? But that doesn't mean there aren't a lot of people that should be sued, and over again. Which brings us back to buyer beware. And it seems not only are clueless Latins sucked into problems like that, so are so many clueless gringos. Look, take the example I just gave about the sunken living room. You'd think a contractor who's been building house after house would be completely up to speed on waterproofing foundations and walls. Nope. This is Latin America, you know. In dealing with building contractors, here's a few more tips. Suppose you've made a deal with a contractor who's building a house down the street for a neighbor. That's how you discovered this guy. His work looks good. The guy that hired him to build the house is very happy with the quality. Well, to me, that's not enough. There's one more step I look at before I hire that guy for anything. I ask him to take me to see a house or a project that he built a couple of years ago. And usually he's a local guy, many of them are, so there'll be one or two projects, even more, within a couple of kilometers. And that's when you look for defects. Because you can be sure those same type of defects are going to show up in any structure he builds for you. So if the lighting's bad in one room or another, there's humidity or mold in the closet, tiles popping off in the laundry room, well, you can make a strong point that you don't want that happening in your house and really pay attention and do your research when they're waterproofing the outside of the foundation. Oh, and by the way, these defects show up routinely in big, expensive projects too. For example, a gringo friend of mine who came down to one of my first Expat Insider seminars, he's living down here in Central America now, and he told me just a couple days ago, he's moving out of his brand new upscale apartment after being there about a year. Yep, he was the very first tenant, and it looked great when he first got in, but he started noticing things. For example, you know how in some apartments there's kind of a popcorn finish, they call it, on the ceiling? Looks like little beads? You might have seen how they do that with a special sprayer. Well, he said they did the popcorn work, but never painted it. So every morning when he first wakes up and walks through that room, there's a tiny little residue of that stuff that fell off overnight, hits the floor, and now it's underfoot. And how could that contractor have avoided that from the start? Well, he could have just put a cone of paint on it. Meanwhile, a year later, you've got an unhappy renter on your hands. All right, we're getting towards the end of the show now. Speaking of my upcoming July Expat Insider Seminar, just go to www.thenewexpat.com and click on Johnny's 2017 seminar link. And again, this time, the John Galt crew will be staging those fabulous pre and post trips. So you'll want to add a couple of extra days before or after the seminar or both. And by the way, if you want to kill two birds with one stone, that is, come to the seminar and start the residency process in Guatemala. You can save yourself a ton of money by doing all that stuff at one time, but you'll have to stay down an extra week or two to do the paperwork and hit the various government offices and such. So, time to work out those details in your Plan B now. Read all about it and sign up for the seminar at www.thenewexpat.com. And for those of you who, as of now, can't get your boots on the ground yet, you can still make great strides by going to www.expatplanb.com. Check out my Expat Essentials course. It's the best way to organize your Plan B before you take that next step, which is boots on the ground.
South of the border.
This is the Expat Files, living in Latin America. If you want me to help you out with your own Plan B, just schedule a one-on-one consult. Send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to learn how to move forward with your own Plan B from right up there in the States, go to www.expatplanb.com and check out my three videos. See ya. Nos vemos.